Yeah, sorry, we have a habit of using long titles in numerical work. Helvi accepted, of course. So yeah, thanks for the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk about this work. It's in a very similar spirit to what Helvi has just talked about. So the connection to quantum gravity is a bit indirect here. Most of the talk is classical, but of course with a bit of a quantum kind of motivation behind it all. This is work we've done together with Chris Moore, Michalis Agathos, Roxana Roska at Cambridge, Davide De Rosa, and Christian Ott from Caltech. And this is a talk about modified gravity. So just like Helvi has already said, I will briefly run through the motivation, why we're looking into this. Of course, general relativity has been a fantastic theory. I mean, it has passed tons of tests with flying colors. And as we all know, the gravitation wave detection from September 2015 has provided a fantastic confirmation of Brunsdicky theory. So why have we reasons to search beyond general relativity? I think all of us probably ultimately expect to be general relativity to be some kind of limit of a more fundamental theory. And if you look at the history of science, this is the standard fate of virtually every theory, except for those that got buried on the graveyard of history immediately. Newtonian gravity is a fantastic approximation, got us to the moon, but of course we know it's a limit of general relativity, which is a more comprehensive theory. Classical theory is still fantastic if you walk around, hit your head against the wall. This is very well described by classical physics, but of course it's a kind of expansion in H-bar of quantum mechanics. And likewise, we expect that general relativity is some kind of leading order expansion of a more fundamental quantum theory of gravity. And the idea here is, in contrast to the majority of talks that went on here, but very much in the same spirit as Helvi's talk, that we are pretty much agnostic about this fundamental theory. We just say, well, there should be some leading order corrections. So we kind of invent some ideas of what leading order corrections we may have. And this often involves the introduction of additional degrees of freedom. Physically, there's, of course, additional motivation. If you take the standard model of particle physics, combine it with general relativity, it has a fantastic capacity of predicting what we see in the universe, from particle colliders to cosmological expansion. And yet we know something's wrong. Something doesn't quite work out. We have dark matter. We are pretty certain of that. Maybe it's a result from the modification of gravity. More likely, as probably most of us would say now, it is some kind of genuine matter, but we still haven't got a clue what. We have dark energy, so we know that we have a cosmological expansion pretty much compatible with lambda. So you may say, okay, well, Lovelock's theorem allows for lambda. However, then you're still stuck with a cosmological constant problem. The magnitude of lambda simply doesn't match anywhere near the value you expect from the zero-point energy. It's the worst discrepancy in physics. So we know something has to be changed here. And this talk is about exploring some possibility, and in particular, looking for smoking gun effects of one modification of gravity, and namely in scalar tensor theory. So scalar tensor theory of gravity has several redeeming features. First of all, scalar fields appear quite naturally in many aspects of more fundamental physics studies. It appears in string theory, the reduction of extra dimensions in theory. One particularly appealing feature of scalar tensor theory, and I'm talking here about Bergmann-Wegener type of theories where you have second order equations of motion, they obey the weak equivalence principle, the covariance principle, and have a single scalar field. They're well posed. The big issue that Helvi had to spend several minutes discussing simply doesn't arise, because we know we have the formulation in the Einstein frame. So this class of scalar tensor theories immediately inherits the well-posedness of general relativity. However, you have a certain lack of smoking gun effects, at least in black hole spacetimes, hence the joke with the Brunsticky theory. The no-hair theorem strongly constrain what kind of signature you may have, actually, if you look at vacuum spacetimes. There are ways to circumvent the underlying assumptions of the no-hair theorems, like boundary conditions, producing some crazy potentials or so. But overall, it's pretty hard. And in these scenarios, while certainly not crazy, they still look a little bit on the contrived side. However, matter couples directly to the scalar field, and therefore it would appear that matter sources are the right environment for looking for smoking gun signatures. And I think the only smoking gun effect that is known to date for modified gravity is the spontaneous scalarization of Damour and Esposito Farese.
Well, so actually, let me add that I would argue that there's a simpler smoking gun for minimally coupled massive scalars. Even black holes are spun down by a massive scalar. That's really a smoking gun of a
I would probably not include that as a modified theory of gravity. You're thinking about the simply a scalar field as a mass source.
Yeah.
Yes, however, my main caveat on that is that the nonlinear saturation kills this effect at about 10%, right?
No, it spins down, right? It's a smoking gun.
Yes, fair enough. It's a smoking gun effect, but I would still argue that the effect of spontaneous scalarization is strong. It's more than 10%.
If it exists.
Okay, this is a good call for making a key statement here. When people talk about modified theories gravity, that doesn't mean they believe in it. The key point is testing general relativity. I mean, of course, as a theorist, I'm sort of hoping that we find some effects. So we have a zoo of theories, and I think for every single one we study, the probability is very likely that we won't see anything. But still, if you go back to the original argument that there must be some more fundamental theory, there must be one winning lot in the lottery. The probability that I picked it here, very, very small. But you're right, Vito, of course, you're right. This is another signature that can be observationally tested. Yes.
I mean, there's one way of evading the no-hair theorems, which is to allow for slow time dependence. And I don't know whether this is how much this has been explored.
I agree. That's true. Yes. I should not say that this is the only smoking gun effect in existence. We will discover more. Absolutely. And this, I think, is a very, very intriguing avenue. I fully agree. Yes.
It's a cosmological scalar. I think the answer is that it's just not that important.
Okay, so the physical scenario I'm going to discuss here is a stellar collapse. The late stage is in the collapse of a dying star. There has been some work on this. People initially studied Oppenheimer-Snyder dust collapse in scalar tensor theory. Later on, there was work in particular by Novak and Ibanez, who studied collapse in scalar tensor theory. Together with Davide Gerosa, we picked up that topic. However, all these studies are for massless theories. And that is a significant ingredient, as we shall see. I assume that not everybody here has a huge astrophysics interest. So I have here sort of a 30 seconds précis of core collapse. So we start with the main sequence, with a zero H main sequence mass of something in the range of 8 to 100 solar masses. The precise values may depend on whom you talk to, but this is the ballpark. So you take a star of that mass, it evolves on the main sequence, becomes a supergiant, and just before it starts breathing its last breath of air, and it is about to die and collapse to a neutron star or a black hole, it has developed this onion layer shape where you have the burning of consecutively heavier elements as you go towards the center of the star. And what we are most interested in here is the stellar core. We're talking about an object about 1,500 kilometers. And in the collapse that ultimately then drives the supernova, this core collapses to the radius of a neutron star, something like 15 kilometers, give or take a factor of 1.5 or so. I've taken 15 here because it matches with the 1,500. And the density increases by 5 orders of magnitude. And all this happens in a fraction of a second. This is in a very energetic process. It releases a huge amount of gravitational energy, however, most of it in neutrinos. Still, there's a considerable amount of energy that goes into other channels, about 1% or 10 to the 51 ergs. That's just one of these crazy units that astrophysicists like, CGS unit for energy. It goes into the outgoing shock, the explosion, and some of it is what you see if you're lucky enough to see a supernova with your naked eye, which none of us have, of course. The explosion mechanism, we're not very interested in that. Suffice it to say that this is a branch of research with lots of activity. People have ideas, but I think the final word hasn't been spoken over really blows up the supernova in reality. But for us, this is not very important. For us, the key thing is that you have the jump from this guy to this guy. And at the end, you fail a neutron star, or if you have a particularly massive star and a failed explosion, you form a black hole. All of this stuff, since I'm a lazy guy, has been handled for us by other guys, in particular, in this case, by Wusley and Hager. They have a website where they give you the stellar profiles for given zero-H main sequence stars for some metallicity, and they give you all the data that we need. These are Newtonian calculations. They calculate the life of a star, and we're only interested in the death, the final fraction of a second of the object. So we take the profiles from them. Actually, they have a few different... The sets of profiles, and we've tested some cases, and it hardly matters. They have more modern profiles, but they include a few other effects. But for this signal, it has practically no implication whatsoever. Here's the theoretical framework. So it is convenient to formulate your theory in terms of the Einstein metric, which has this bar on top here. And this simply translates a non-minimally coupled scalar field to a minimally coupled scalar field. The price you pay is that the matter then does not couple to the metric you're really evolving, but to a conformally rescaled version of this metric. But still, this simplifies to quite some extent the task of numerically modeling that.
Are there strong constraints from fifth force experiments on this type of interaction?
Yes, I come to that in a moment.
Okay.
Yeah. The conformer factor is significantly constrained. We do this in spherical symmetry. I don't think anyone could do this in 3 plus 1, because the simulations we do, they need to last for several seconds, and this is brutally expensive. We need a lot of simulations. However, given that the key effect is simply the transition of a low density state to a very high density state, where then spontaneous scalarization can kick in, we are pretty convinced that this captures the key dynamics that we're interested in. I eat my hat if somebody comes with a 3 plus 1 simulation and finds something completely different. So ultimately, we have a comparatively simple system for the metric. Because it's spherical symmetry, we only have the constraint equations for the lapse function and the radio component of the metric. We have a wave equation for the scalar field, and the most complicated part are the matter equations. However, because of this use of the Einstein frame, we are actually able to completely use, without change, the general relativity framework for the high-resolution shock capturing scheme that was written by Evan O'Connor and Christian Ott. So we took their code, it's a public code, and we added the scalar tensor theory part to it. We need to prescribe an equation of state We follow an approach that is very popular and common in the modeling, for instance, of neutron stars or stellar collapse. We use piecewise polytropic equation of state. So it separates at the nuclear density, which we set to 2 times 10 to the 14 gram per cubic centimeter. So we have a part, a low density part, that's the indices 1, which is comparatively well known from physics, from the microphysics. And then we have a somewhat less clear part described by the second polytropic exponent. However, we find that the value of gamma 2 hardly plays a role for the signature of the wave of the radiation. We have a cold contribution to the pressure, and we have a thermal contribution. However, the thermal contribution really only plays a part after the core bounds, because for a smooth evolution, you can convince yourself that the first law of thermodynamics actually pretty much keeps the thermal pressure at 0. So we have 3 key parameters here. We have the low density, the high density part, and then an index for the thermal pressure. And now to answer your question, these are the constraints on these theories. We use a coupling function that has 2 coefficients. This is the standard kind of Taylor expansion of the coupling function that people use. Incidentally, alpha and beta are directly related to the Eddington parameterized post-Newtonian parameters, which is one reason why people use this coupling function. And alpha and beta are very strongly constrained from solar system experiments and the binary pulsar observations. So you have your beta plane, and beta cannot be smaller than minus 4.5, because if you go beyond that value, you have exactly the spontaneous scalarization kicking in, which is such a massive effect that this is precisely what allows you to constrain your theory. And alpha, due to mostly to the Cassini probe, is very small. However, these constraints are valid for massless theory or for theories with a very low mass, because they depend on the length scale. For a sufficiently massive scalar field, your Compton wavelength is way shorter than the length scales that are probed by the solar system test. And therefore, and this is the key point for us, you do not have these constraints. Alpha and beta can be larger if you allow for a massive scalar field. And the regime that is of particular interest has been identified in this work by Ramazanoglu and Pretorius, and we use it also as the range that we study numerically. And it's about 10 to the minus 15 to 10 to the minus 12 electron volts.
If you convert this scale to kilometers.
Oh, yeah. Bloody hell. I can convert 10 to
15.
10 to the 8, 10 to the 9.
Yeah, it's larger than that. I know the 10 to the minus 14 electron volt correspond to roughly a frequency of 20 hertz. So you need to multiply that with it. But I think you get something closer to what was mentioned here. It's larger than the 10 to 15 kilometers.
It's the binary separation, right?
The it's roughly that, yeah.
Binary separation is 10 to the 15 kilometers?
No. It's in kilometers, I think it's 10 to the 5, roughly.
Okay.
It's smaller than an astronomical unit, for sure.
Okay.
So that's sort of the ballpark. Significantly smaller than an AU.
In solar system constraints, they don't affect that?
And no, because the Yukawa part of the dams the effect exponentially. You screened. So we have 6 parameters: the mass of the scalar field, 2 parameters for the coupling function, 3 for the equation of state. We've done a convergence test. I'm not going to say more about it than that. The error, the numerical error in our waveforms, is of the order of 5%. So here are some waveform examples. So you have we start with our progenitor model collapsed to effectively a neutron star, and then we have the scalar field multiplied by the extraction radius, and this is how it looks like. So you have a steep decrease here to something like 10 minus 10. The sign is irrelevant. It could be plus. Yeah, this is a choice. of roughly 10 to the 5 centimeters. And in comparison with the massless cases, this orders of magnitude larger. And the reason is that we have a much bigger range of choices for the alpha and beta parameters, because these are not constrained. So for large alpha, or alternatively for a small alpha and a large negative beta value, you get these humongously large amplitude signals, several orders of magnitude larger than what you
so
can.
So is this independent of where you extract the field, or does it decay?
I come to that. This is the most important part that comes on the remaining slides. The answer is basically the amplitude does change with the extraction radius. So here we have a fiducial set of parameters here, 10 to the minus 14 electron volt, alpha is about 10 to the minus 2, beta minus 20. And these are very canonical parameters for the equation of state. People who know more about core collapse than I do tell me this is a pretty sensible choice. And if you vary the several of the parameters, you make alpha smaller or larger, or you use a different gamma 2, it hardly changes. You see, even there are differences, of course, in detail, but overall, it's always the same pattern. So you have a strong peak and then this oscillatory feature. The strongest effect actually is the increasing the mass here, or decreasing it, then you get the inverse effect. The oscillation frequency goes up. But overall, it's always the same pattern. And now to come to Vita's question, this is what I've just shown you as a signal at small distance from the star. It was about 0.1 light seconds from the star. So you might wonder, of course, what happens for LIGO. And so the signal LIGO we see looks completely different. So here's a kind of a cartoon sketch. You have your star, it goes boom, forms a black hole or a neutron star, and you sit somewhere on the edge of the cylinder with your LIGO detector toy and you start measuring. Question is, what do you see? In the massless case, the answer is very simple. Provided you extract sufficiently far from your source, you can just use the massless wave equation, propagate your signal, and the only thing is that you have this 1/r scaling and you change time to retarded time. Your signal is just as it vectored as it goes outwards with a 1/r falloff. However, we have a massive signal, the picture looks completely different. So here's, let's for simplicity we assume you have a Gaussian pulse, this is time goes up, it's retarded time here in radius, therefore it's a characteristic curve. In the massless case, this pulse would just go here, decrease in amplitude, that's it. In the massive case, your signal is composed of many, many modes in the Fourier domain, and every mode propagates at a different speed. Modes with an infinite frequency propagate at the speed of light. Modes with a very low frequency don't propagate at all. They're exponentially damped. You carve a fall off, effectively. And intermediate frequencies propagate with a speed that is lower than the speed of light. So what you have is dispersion. And therefore, you have to solve the massive wave equation. And this part here, omega star, is just a way to phrase the mass in terms of a frequency. This changes everything. It turns out to work. It turns out easier to work with the rescaled field. We call it sigma here, r phi. And we solve this equation in the Fourier domain, where you can do it pretty much analytically. It's not a simple calculation, but it's straightforward. Provided you use the stationary phase approximation, and here's why you can do that. So as the signal propagates outwards, the following things happen. Low frequencies are suppressed. They go. The high frequency part of the power spectrum is completely unaffected. You can easily show this analytically. It's a trivial calculation. The signal spreads out in time because low frequency modes arrive later and later. High frequencies arrive earlier than low frequencies, and the signal becomes increasingly oscillatory. We've tested this here by extracting the signal at two different extraction radii. The blue one is the one we had before. And then we extract it at the same radius, but plus 1 light second. And the fact is, first of all, as Vita had already expected, the amplitude goes down, that's correct. And the signal becomes increasingly oscillatory. Note that the length between two pulses here decreases, that the kind of wavelength decreases. The power spectrum is plotted here, frequency, power, and the blue spectrum, because it's already extracted at a finite radius, it has a slight suppression below this cutoff frequency omega star. But if you go to a larger radius, you completely lose all the energy in the low frequency regime. They're gone. Whereas the high part, they're actually two curves, red on top of blue. It's completely unchanged. And because of this, your signal ultimately becomes highly oscillatory. The phase varies much more rapidly than the frequency. And the approximation you then use is called the stationary phase approximation. Yeah, pretty much, yeah. This is most, I think I have two more slides. I'm not gonna say how this works. Google for it if you're interested in. So here's the signal that we obtain at astrophysical distances. So here we have a source 10 kiloparsecs away. That's 30,000 light years. And the signal completely changes its character. What we have here is, in the bottom plot, this is time measured in 10 to the 9 seconds. And this is the frequency. So you see, this is retarded time. So infinite frequencies arrive at the same time as the speed of light signals would arrive. But low frequencies arrive increasingly later. And here's the amplitude of the signal. And it pretty much is, it has a very, very, very slow decay in time, but it's extremely long-lived. So for this particular case, 10 to the 10 seconds, if you work it out, it's about 300 years. And this is still well above the threshold of LIGO. And we have an analytic expression for the frequency evolution, which is the first smoking gun effect. So LIGO has three channels to possibly observe supernova collapse in modified theories of gravity. In the massless or very, very low mass case, you have pretty much the same picture people already knew. You have a short burst, and you can use the burst pipelines to search for them. However, if you have a massive signal with a magnitude in the range that we've studied, you have a quasi-continuous wave signal. The frequency and amplitude practically do not change over time scales of months. So you can take your LIGO detector, integrate over a month, and search for this, for a monochromatic signal. And of course, in astrophysics, you have tons of these signals, and you may alternatively calculate, this is ongoing work, a stochastic background generated by all the supernovae going off from between here, Virgo cluster, and so on. I cannot give you the answer yet to that. That's work in progress. And because the time scales are so long, it is worthwhile looking at historic supernovae. Because after 300 years, you still have a signal well above the LIGO sensitivity, unless your theory is wrong, of course. So you should see something if the theory is right. And if you don't see anything, you can rule out a significant fraction of the parameter space by using existing LIGO pipelines and directing them at historic supernovae like 1987A or the Kepler one, for instance. Okay, and these are the conclusions, and I do it much more briefly in words. Strong scalarization because we do not have the constraints from the Cassini probe and binary pulses. Dispersion spreads out your signal over years or even centuries, and there are separate LIGO pipelines, existing LIGO pipelines. LIGO doesn't have to write anything new for that, where we can search for these signals, and if we don't see them, we can constrain these parameters well beyond what we know so far. Thank you.
So you can actually, so I'm curious how far you can go down. So with Luis Lehner, Jun Zhang, Laura Savinsky, and Mary Sikelariadu, we showed that you can, with the observed neutron star merger, get a constraint on the mass.
Yes, I would expect that.
Scalar,
yeah.
Down to about 20-ish kilometers. So that would get down to rough, that's about 10 to the minus 11 eV, if I've done the conversion correctly.
Yeah.
So how far down can you go with this?
We have not run anything beyond 10 to the minus 12, so I do not know. People have speculated that this effect should still be there at higher masses. But this is there's a paper by some Japanese guys on static neutron star models. So I do not know how this would hold up in the dynamic case.
The oscillations you pointed out, they totally they modify
yes.
the post-merger signal in the merger. So here probably it modifies the quasi-normal modes of your exploded.
Yeah. Right. At the end of our paper, I think, which came out before yours, or the one you were referencing, we speculate that neutron stars might be an even better probe to constrain these theories, yes.
The last question, Mohammed.
So when you said the discretization error is 5%, I don't know what you mean by that, and is it the same level for all frequencies, or is it concentrated on some frequencies?
I have to admit, it's the error, strictly speaking, only in the time domain. Since we then take a Fourier spectrum, that sort of gives us the initial data for then performing the or calculating the signal in the time domain at LIGO's position. I do not know whether the error stays exactly at 5%, but it's not going to change dramatically. Maybe it goes up to 10%, I do not know, but it's the same ballpark. So for the main conclusions, it's basically insignificant. But you're right, this is something we should actually calculate.
So I suggest then we thank Ulrich again.